Good morning. My name is Toni Bond Leonard. I'm the board president of the National Network of Abortion Funds, as well as the co-founder and president CEO of African American Women Evolving, which has an abortion fund housed within its organization. I have to apologize. You had a really good and wonderful PowerPoint presentation that I labored over, but I left my USB drive at the hotel, so I can't upload it. But I am confident that I can give you a picture of how what you've heard from many of my esteemed colleagues, how this all shakes out in the day-to-day lives of the women that the member abortion funds work with. I have no financial relationship to disclose. I'm going to talk to you about the role of abortion funds, their inner workings, how we help women, state and national advocacy work that some of us are involved in, and how our work is really framed in a larger context of reproductive justice. Every year, tens of thousands of poor women and teens are faced to carry a pregnancy to term because they can't afford to pay for an abortion. Bans on public funding of abortion, such as the Hyde Amendment, which you all have heard about, burden some of the most disadvantaged women in our society, those who rely on the government for health care. Many thousands more would be denied this fundamental human and constitutional right were it not for the National Network of Abortion Funds, which is an association of 104 grassroots community-based funds in 43 states, the District of Columbia, and Canada, that help women pay for abortions. When women and girls cannot afford to pay for a safe legal abortion, they come to the member funds of the network for help. Abortion funds are local grassroots groups that provide direct financial assistance to cover the direct cost of abortion care and oftentimes related services. Each year, members of the network raise and distribute a combined amount of over $2.6 million to over 23,000 women and girls in need. What has really served as a central barrier to economically disadvantaged women accessing abortion services has been the denial of funding for abortion in government health programs for low-income people. With the landmark decision in 1973 around Roe v. Wade, women had the fundamental right to obtain an abortion, and poor women who qualified for health care through the Medicaid program were covered for abortion just as they were for other medical care. But in 1976, Congress took that fundamental right away from poor women by passing the Hyde Amendment. While that ban has been loosened in some states owing to executive order and court challenges at state levels, the barrier continues to exist, and women and girls are forced to carry pregnancies to term. And when you add to that, restrictions like parental consent and notification, waiting periods, and or shortages in abortion providers, you have a picture not only of unequal access, but one that highlights blatant race and class inequities. Women of color who are disproportionately represented among low-income women, young women who must rely upon their parents' support, uninsured immigrant and undocumented women face some of the greatest challenges in trying to obtain an abortion. The average cost of an abortion, as you've heard, can range anywhere from almost $500 to almost thousands of dollars, depending upon the week's gestation. While most abortions are obtained well before the 12th week of gestation, coming up with the money, even for a first trimester abortion for many women, is still a tremendous burden. For the women who call upon funds, accessing a safe abortion really goes well beyond raising the money for the abortion. The fact that they need financial assistance to get an abortion highlights an even greater disparity, which is the need for economic parity and access to health care in general, for not just the privileged few, but for everybody. For those women struggling to make ends meet day to day, raising the money for the abortion means that they're forced to go to desperate measures. Some of the women who call the fund forego paying their rent. They may not pay their utilities. They may decide that they're going to have less food for themselves and their families. They might even say they're going to try and borrow some money, but borrowing money, not understanding that they're going to be incurring a debt that they still have to worry about paying back down the line. And many women, not many, but some women, go to very desperate measures and decide that they're going to attempt to self-abort because they just can't come up with the money to get the abortion. There was one woman who contacted one of the funds looking for money, and she had went to the health food store to buy all of the herbs that had warnings about taking while being pregnant. She couldn't come up with the money to get the abortion, but she had just enough money to go to the health food store and buy some herbs. She eventually did self-abort, but had some severe medical consequences afterwards. If a woman lives in an area where there are no where there's no provider or a clinic, she also has to factor in money for transportation, depending upon how far the clinic is. And if she is in the second trimester, she might also have to raise money for housing. Some abortion funds help pay for transportation to the clinic, housing for women who must travel far from home to reach the clinic. Some funds will help pay for child care during the procedure. Some funds offer options counseling, and some funds offer support for the ultrasound. Some funds will even pay for the pregnancy tests, and many funds have started to help women obtain emergency contraception, and some will even pay for the follow-up care after the abortion. Because the need is so great, and funds are really, most funds are only able to fund women who live in their demographic area, but because the need is so great, we do have some member funds who will go beyond their demographic area and fund at a national level to help women in other states. Recognizing that direct financial assistance is really a short-term stopgap measure, and that the real solution is change in the public policies that impede access, the network's member funds are also involved in state advocacy initiatives that challenge some of the restrictive measures. These include campaigns to repeal the Hyde Amendment at the state level, working in state coalitions to challenge parental notification and mandatory waiting laws, and working to increase state Medicaid reimbursements to clinics. Many clinics will not even accept Medicaid for the few cases it does cover, like rape and incest, because of low rates of reimbursement or delays in receiving the reimbursements. For example, in Illinois, we have most of the clinics in the urban areas don't accept Medicaid as a form of reimbursement, and reasons that we have been given include the ridiculous amount of red tape to even become, you know, get the provider number. One clinic has said that they did apply for reimbursement 2 years ago, and they're still waiting for their reimbursement. The other work that the network is doing at the national level, and you've heard about the Hyde 30 Years is Enough campaign, which is really to highlight the inequities of the Hyde Amendment and to work towards its ultimate repeal. The network has also published a policy report called Abortion Funding, A Matter of Justice, which really highlights the unfairness of the Hyde Amendment and places this issue within a reproductive justice context, lifting up the intersectionality of race and class and presenting this as a form of reproductive oppression. Most abortion funds are independent, grassroots, nonprofit organizations that are ran by volunteers. My fund is one of the few funds that is able to afford to have a part-time staff person, but by and large, most funds are ran by very committed volunteers. Some funds are affiliated with progressive religious organizations, coalitions, or nonprofit clinics. Only a few abortion funds have, as I said, have paid staff members. Some funds have hotline services and take calls directly from women seeking help, while other funds work directly through family planning or abortion clinics. A handful of funds receive some support from private foundations, but by and large, most of us raise our money from individual donors. Most of us provide support to women through grants. About a quarter of us give loans to women, understanding that in all actuality, most times we probably will not get any or any of the money back, or maybe just a little bit of the money back. The above really highlights not only, I think, the commitment of activists around the country, but the individuals who support us, who recognize that the time has to come soon when no woman is denied access to abortion services. I want to leave you with a brief story about two sisters who contacted our fund last year, and they didn't contact us themselves. Another woman from another agency who was working with them contacted us. These two sisters, one was in her first trimester, one was in her second trimester, both from the Congo, both pregnant as a result of being raped during military war in the Congo. And in addition to trying to, in addition to making the trek here to the United States and all the challenges in being able to do that, they also had to figure out how to terminate this pregnancy. And in addition, the sister who was in her second trimester needed a 3-day procedure. So not only, as I said, she needed money for the abortion, but she needed housing for food. I mean, needed money for housing, needed money for transportation. Of course, you can't just give somebody help to get transportation, to get to the clinic, to get the abortion, but you also have to make sure that they have food. So she needed money for food. And after the abortion, there was really the need to help her hook into organizations to help her deal with being a survivor of being sexually assaulted, and also being a victim of basically a war crime. So as you see, and I hope I've successfully laid out that the issue of abortion is so much more than just women being able to get money or shortages in providers or where they are in their trimester. Are they first trimester, second trimester? It really is that, as well as all of these other factors, race and class, that are added up together to make abortion really inaccessible for low-income women. So I'm going to end there, and thank you.
Thank you to the panel for really some moving and excellent talks. I'd like to take questions from the audience for individual members of the panel or for the panel as a whole. In the back.
We use chart review for the very basics: age, last menstrual period, gravidity, parity, quick medical history, pretty simple things. And that was really due to efficiency. You know, we could have had study staff ask those questions or just pick it up from the intake sheet. So they were very simple things. In terms of gestational age, we, for our primary study, wanted to capture the thoughts and the impressions that the women had in terms of how they got to the clinic when they did. So we were looking at abortion delay, and we were looking at the factors that were associated with them requesting abortion on the day that they did. So what we wanted to capture were the issues related to women getting in the door at that moment without having been counseled and undergoing medical examination and certain procedures that may affect or bias the reporting in the survey. So we used a last menstrual period or ultrasound determination, and that was really on a case-by-case basis because the usual protocol for that clinic was for patients to come in, register, sit in the waiting area for some time, and we figured that that was the best time to actually capture our data, was once they had registered and had a little bit of a wait time, which, you know, kind of helped with our response rate as well. You know, we wanted to capture their thoughts right at that moment, or prior to counseling and other medical interventions. However, a lot of women prior to their finding their way to that clinic had already had an ultrasound, and it was well documented based on gestational age. So yes, there were a few where we had to kind of reassign them after they had their ultrasound. The clinic there does do an ultrasound after the counseling, and we did go back and check. We had access to the medical record. Thanks.
Any other in the back?
The network is looking at how to, ways to effectively collect some of the stories. There are two resources that the network does offer. One is a video called Legal But Out of Reach, which tells the story of several women's experiences around trying to obtain an abortion. Of course, I mentioned the matter of abortion funding, the matter of access report that the network has done. There are some stories in there as well. Some of the individual funds are collecting stories, and as I said, the network is working on this kind of systematic way of, you know, kind of collecting them in one centralized place.
Other panel members? Comment?
Well, we, PERCH does is working on a story bank collecting our physician stories that are related to anything from the Hyde Amendment and the effect that it has on our patients to anything that we work on. And so when we do advocacy, and we did last October, we did a lobby day in Washington on the Hyde Amendment, and we brought 16 doctors to D.C. and had, you know, 25 meetings with members on the Hill to talk about repealing Hyde. And something that we rely on greatly is patient stories and from the physician perspective. But there isn't, as far as I know, a coordinated effort in terms of the coalition to collect stories from everybody about that. So I think that's an interesting idea.
And one thing just to mention also in a similar movement is Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need Coalition has really put a large emphasis on collecting of stories to use in advocacy efforts around healthcare reform. And so that's another avenue that maybe could be connected.
Other? Okay. Other questions? Yes.
I know that substantiating claims of sexual assault are very difficult. So when you guys talked about getting funding from victims of rape or incest, how is it proven or shown that someone is actually a victim?
That's a great question, and I think the answer is there's no consistency, and just as the laws vary from state to state, it really is a patchwork system. And when you're talking about that the law does require coverage for rape, as we were saying and as Susie pointed out, it's not happening on the ground. And so I think it depends on the individual level and the systems level of just who's in charge of that particular patient and who's doing the reporting. So as far as I know, there's not consistency in terms of how it's reported and how it therefore gets paid.
But even in cases where there's been an actual law enforcement presence in the clinic to observe the chain of command of the products of conception from the doctor to the police, even in those cases, in some states, there's still not payment coming into the clinic.
In the back?
Hi, I'm Kelly Blanchard from IBIS Reproductive Health. I just wanted to add on that last point. We're in the process of a study of abortion providers looking at their ability to access Medicaid funds for cases that meet the exception criteria. The point about that you just raised about the inconsistency is one that we're generally seeing. We're also seeing that providers are afraid of being accused of Medicaid fraud, and that it's partly about what is the definition that's not consistent, but it's also partly about providers being nervous that Medicaid, no matter what evidence they have, that Medicaid is going to come back and say, well, that wasn't enough. And so it sort of comes from both sides. I think there's a fear about because there's no consistent definition, it leaves a lot of room open for people to feel like they might get in trouble down the line. And then some providers are, in fact, asking for more than is actually required by Medicaid. Medicaid doesn't say that they need, for example, a police report or anything like that, but some providers feel like to protect themselves, they actually have to require something like that. So it sort of becomes a self-censorship thing, too, that people feel like they have to go to extreme lengths because we know Medicaid is so
important. Okay. Okay, Ms. Rowe, and then in the back. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lisa Curtis-Stein with the National Women's Law Center and working with many of the panelists and really enjoyed your presentations. My question is for Jessica. I know you mentioned that of your study participants, 68% reported that they were paying out of pocket for their termination procedures. And it's something that we've been trying to better understand, the availability of private insurance coverage of termination of pregnancy. Something that we've been chatting about in the office and wondering if there's any way to substantiate this in your study is wondering whether women are foregoing the possibility of getting any insurance reimbursement just out of privacy concerns, and our attempt to better document that actually a lot of health, private health insurance does in fact cover abortion services, and trying to think about that as the foundation to work from in our arguments for healthcare reform and making sure that it does cover abortion.
That is a fantastic question. It's actually the focus of the next study, which is going to be a qualitative study in the same population where we actually try and dissect out some of these factors more and more. It just wasn't possible with the current study in order to establish that, but I would love to talk to you about it more.
Okay, there's a question in the back. Okay, please.
I'll bite. In terms of the duplication of efforts, I mean, I think for each of the groups that have been represented up here, I mean, I think, you know, we have those that are doing the research, which is very necessary. We have the legal focus, and we have the provider focus, you know, with the physician. And then we have the work that's being done by the folks, kind of like the activists at the grassroots level, trying to help, you know, women really, you know, kind of be able to access abortion, you know, given their day-to-day reality. So some duplication, but really, I mean, each of us kind of have our unique kind of niche and focus. In terms of the involvement of men, I mean, frankly, this hasn't been, I'm going to step out on that. It hasn't really been a movement that has been welcoming or embracing of men for many reasons, good and bad. I think the fear has been that when men come to the table or, you know, begin to work on this issue, that the focus gets moved away from women, which, you know, sometimes it is the case, but we certainly have to figure out how to bring men into this movement because, you know, most women don't get pregnant by immaculate conception. And so, you know, when they have conversations, when the women who call the funds talk to us about, you know, who are they talking to about getting the abortion, you know, many times they are talking to their partners, you know, about trying to come up. That's one of the first questions that most of the abortion funds ask, you know, is the father around and have you asked him for any help towards the abortion? You know, more times than not, they say, yes, I have, and they might say, you know, he doesn't have, you know, any money either, or he's giving me all that, you know, all that that I have. You know, he's giving me what he can. So I think we have to figure out, you know, how do we create a space for men to really be a part of this work, because they have to be, where a space where at the same time the focus doesn't move off of women. I mean, the similar thing has happened really around why this work has come to be, really start to be framed within a context of reproductive justice and not just abortion specific, because of the push by, you know, women of color that this is so much broader than just being able to get an abortion. It's also all of these ancillary issues of why we can't get an abortion.
I also think your question speaks to sort of the larger question of how reproductive justice is marginalized within the larger progressive community. And I don't, you know, have an answer for that right now, but I think it's something to always keep in mind when we're talking about sort of large non-traditional coalition partners being the more sort of general progressive groups that cover a lot of issues, and how reproductive health and justice sort of fits into that. So I think it's a larger conversation.
Other panel responses?
I mean, it's part of the reason, I think, for the Low Income Easy Access Coalition, and part of the National Institute is really interested in kind of bringing state and local advocates together and to learn from one another and share information and share resources, and also to connect them with national advocates so that they're not duplicating what's already been created, but can really share those resources. And same with the summit in November.
Okay, I had a question in the back in the corner, second, in the back that I think I missed by mistake, and then...
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Okay, please.
I just wanted to add, I think we don't have enough people working on this issue. Over the period of time that HIVE has been around, which is forever, I think we're not seeing much movement. I think we've got coming in from every single angle to raise awareness. I have to say my first reaction about the question of men, too, is all those men in Congress who continue to keep voting for the HIVE amendments. And I think that's where everyone has really focused their efforts on trying to do that, and we're not seeing much movement. And so I would say the more people, the more groups, the more information that we can get from the providers, the doctors, the, you know, whatever angle of this is really critical, because we haven't yet figured out what the combination of all these things are, which will sort of get into the public consciousness, get into the consciousness of Congress people, and change the amendments. And I just also wanted to add one other thing that's come up in our study, and I think it's so important to say, is the abortion funds are in some ways sort of saving many women in this country in a way that the federal government is supposed to do and is not doing. And that comes up again and again in our research, and I just want to say that out there so that everyone can recognize that this is critical and amazing work that they do, and we should all support our local abortion funds.
Okay. Okay. All right. We have time for about two more questions, and then we have to clear out so the next group can start. So all the way in the back, and then...
I was wondering about the role of medication abortion in increasing access across the U.S. If anybody has insight about that. Well,
the same funding barriers exist, and the price of medical abortion is comparable to surgical, so...
Okay. One last question? Anybody? Okay, then I thank you all for being here, and again, much thanks to the panel. It was a wonderful panel.
Did I?
I mean, a little bit, yeah. I talk to Steph Sterling a lot sometimes, too.
So I also have
to do